Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is episode 122, recording on the 8th of December. I am Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Marsh Davis.
And...
Graham Smith.
And the news this week is... there's a bunch, but Psychonauts 2 seems like a big deal. That was announced at the PlayStation Experience thingy, and they're doing a Kickstarter for it, although it's not a Kickstarter, it's a FIG, which is... Does it stand for Fund Indie Games?
I don't know. That's what I guessed that it stood for.
It's their own crowdfunding thing that they set up a little while back, specifically for things like this, where both the crowd can invest and also investors can invest. And they said that the pitch for it was like that it was going to be all of you can make money on the games, but actually you have to be an accredited investor to do the investment part, and that's the only time you get a return on your investment.
Oh, yeah, I remember that now.
I think you need $1 million to do that.
How's it done on FIG so far?
It's doing great. It's 35, when I last checked, which I think it was yesterday, it was 35 days left and it was over halfway to its 3.3 million goal.
Oh, okay.
So it's going to make it.
I mean, you were wondering, I think, in to me privately, that it might not make the target because simply because FIG has a lower profile as a funding platform than Kickstarter does. But that doesn't seem to be the case, I guess, then.
No, it seems to be doing fine. I remember... what's the name of the cool space game they found on this?
Outer Wilds?
Outer Wilds, yeah. That only just scraped through. Right. And that was a bit of a shock, because that's an awesome, awesome game.
Didn't it also win the IGF last year?
Yeah, the grand prize winner of the IGF. Absolutely brilliant. Free demo out there for anyone to play. You can see how brilliant it is. It's, you know, absolutely...
Yeah, no, I can see why Psychonauts would do better than even that. Though.
Yeah, that's not a surprise.
Yeah, I think Psychonauts 2 got a million within the first 24 hours. But it's interesting that it's not being entirely funded through FIG. It's part funded through FIG, and then they say they've got more money. Well, they're putting in their own money, but then they've also got money from a publisher.
Yeah.
Have they said who that publisher is?
I think they just said a third party, so I actually wondered if it was an investor rather than a publisher. Yeah.
Could be Notch.
Yeah, because I did wonder that, because when they're talking about that, that's... if you're thinking 3.3 million sounds like a lot to not be the entire figure... when Notch was looking to fund Psychonauts 2, or sort of joking about it on Twitter, and then suddenly became quite serious, Tim was saying it wasn't, you know, a $3 million game. It was more like an $18 million game.
Yeah.
So I think that's the kind of ballpark. And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Notch was involved. I guess the interesting thing about the crowdfunding part of it is this is probably at least as well as the adventure game did, right? Because that was only asking for 300,000 and they made 3.3 million as the final amount. This is clearly going to sail way past 3.3 million. And so if people, the sort of narrative around Double Fine has often been about things they failed to do and deadlines they've missed and screw-ups around certain things. And there's this very passionate base of people who are just fucking livid with them. Or just every comments thread about a Double Fine game will have a couple of these people saying, I can't believe they fucking betrayed me on this. And lots of people think that the Kickstarter was a scam for Broken Age, even though it's out now. Like, even now people are saying, I never finished Broken Age. But this obviously shows that there's been either there's been no significant erosion of trust that, you know, affects them in a material way like that, or just Psychonauts is just such a bigger name that
People are coming back to it, even so.
But then the Double Fine Adventure was the biggest games Kickstarter ever at the time, and it kind of, you know...
The catalyst for the whole thing.
It popularized the whole crowdfunding and games thing itself, so the topic must have been a hot one, right? It must wasn't like... the concept of bringing up like adventure games wasn't exciting. So maybe Psychonauts is an even huger deal? Maybe Psychonauts is the reason that the adventure game one did well, or... I don't know.
Are you guys personally excited for it?
It's just a kind of wait and see thing for me, because I do love the levels in Psychonauts and the fiction and the writing and stuff, but I found it very frustrating as a platformer, and I probably will find this frustrating too. And to be honest, it's a similar situation with the adventure game where I was looking forward to exploring a cool world and stuff, but not in any way excited about playing an adventure game because I've never been a fan of the actual puzzles and the logic, and I wasn't again. And so I imagine that would be the same situation.
I feel quite similarly. I guess I quite look forward to watching maybe other people play Psychonauts 2 on the YouTube more than I like playing it myself.
Yes, I will watch Kim's playthrough.
And if they were doing a doc, they might be, I haven't actually checked, but they were doing a documentary again. All right, they are.
And it's going to be free this time.
Yeah.
Right?
And so I backed the Double Fine Adventure mostly to see the documentary, yeah, and I was very pleased with that decision, and it was great. And I got, well, I definitely got my money's worth out of it. And then they said, somebody else said something about them saying, oh, they've learned their lesson this time because they're making the documentary free to everyone. You don't have to be a backer. And I thought, that's an interesting lesson to learn, because now I'm not going to back it.
Yeah,
I would have backed it for that. But
that's what I was going to say. Like, I would back it instantly if they were doing a documentary again. And now that I know that they are, but it's for free, it's like, oh, okay, well then, no.
The only like, controversy I can remember about the documentary, other than, you know, people getting upset about things they saw on the documentary, was that eventually they did make it free on YouTube, and some backers got upset, I think, about, like, or some people just said, well, why would I even back now, because they're going to be free for everyone. But it was like lagging behind, I think, by two or three episodes. Yeah. And if that was the problem, doesn't seem like, well, I suppose there was, making them free there does solve that.
Weird inconsistencies with the way that they would communicate with their backers versus the public. Yeah. And that caused problems at certain points where they would make changes and they were trying to communicate that privately to the backers and say, this information is just for you backers. Don't tell anyone for like a week.
It was optimistic.
But then instantly it would leak and Double Fine would get upset. The worst of it was when the game came out, for Act 1, they sent it out to all the backers.
Oh,
so like 40,000 people had the game and were playing it. But they said, but press, don't you go reviewing it until it comes out in a week's time.
Right, yeah.
And it's like, but I'm
it's
pretty,
not how things
you know,
work.
Like, but it's out now. And every fucking asshole with a blog or a commenter is writing about it. Like our forum is full of reviews of it. Why can't we review it ourselves? This is idiotic. And yeah, so maybe it's to do with that. Like it makes much more sense when you're making a thing and you're trying to sell a thing and anything you say about it is marketing. Even if it's a completely honest third-party documentary, it's still a form of marketing. It makes sense to make that available to everyone rather than to the people who have already given you their money. That's probably not what this commenter was referring to, but that's the lesson that Double Fine should have learned.
Yeah, I think now I come to think about it, he probably just meant that they won't have that awkward situation of making them free later and then backers being feeling like they paid for something that they thought was exclusive and ended up not being exclusive. Now it's just clear it's not exclusive, you don't get it at all. it's just for everyone. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
I don't think I've ever played a Double Fine game and really loved it or even necessarily liked it that much.
Yeah.
But I really like them. I like the spirit in which they operate. I like Tim Schafer's sense of humor. I think he's a funny writer. And watching the documentary made me just kind of want to root for them. I think they're probably nice people trying to do nice things.
Yeah, well, that's true of most developers, isn't it?
Yeah, but I didn't watch, you know, 20 hours of most developers.
Are you not, as much as you root for them, are you not inspired to some sort of derision about their practices, which seem so haphazard?
Not really, no, because after watching the documentary, I feel like the haphazardness under which they work is grossly exaggerated by, you know, internet perception. And
I thought the video was what actually put a lot of this stuff out in the open about how many producers they are seemingly doing not a great deal on a lot of the games and Tim's crazier and crazier demands.
Well, there are points where I could see like how they get into the holes they do in terms of the production process, especially as far as Tim Schafer goes as being like a bottleneck for the creative process, especially on Broken Age. But I don't think that's true across all of their games.
Right.
I don't think that's what went wrong with Space-Based DF9, which, you know, it wasn't one of Tim Schafer's main projects or anything like that.
I should listen to that. That wasn't my interpretation of the documentary because I haven't seen it. But that's just going by what other people have told me about
it. I never got the impression from it that they had too many producers. And in fact, you know, they hire a producer a third of the way through and it seems like that's the best fucking thing they did. They hired someone to handle their schedule and stuff like that who helped bring the project in on time. And they hired, I think during the documentary, they just hire a generic business guy so that Tim can focus on the creative side of things so they can have someone that's working out where they're going to get money. Like that, I think the main mistake they made with Double Fine Adventure was simply not understanding Kickstarter, because no one really did maybe at that point.
Mm.
And their Kickstarter project was, hey, we're going to make a game of some sort, like the games you used to like. And literally no other information about what that game is. Like, if you did that now, your Kickstarter would not be backed. They didn't have, not just that they didn't have a demo, they didn't have a screenshot or a name of the game or the plot of the game, anything, any actual detail about what the game was going to be. They just said, we want to make an adventure game like we used to. Can we have 300,000? And they intended for it to be this quite small, probably iOS type thing that would take a couple of hours. And then they got given $3.3 million. And everyone's expectation of them was different. And so they had to scale up to meet that expectation. And I think that's what causes, you know, that the fuck up happened on day one, basically. That's how I feel about it. And then the rest of it was them trying to work out how the hell do we, because if they just released that iOS game, everyone would have been angry at them because that wasn't the game that they imagined in their heads when they saw that Tim Schafer was going to make a adventure game again and just got given $3.3 million to do it.
The best thing for them, I'm not suggesting this is a good thing in general, but would be if Kickstarter didn't show the funding total and it just showed a percentage. And once it hit 100, it just stayed at 100. And so even if it hit 100 on day one, people could still see, oh, it's hit its goal, but you know, you still get these rewards and it would still make its 3.3 million, but they wouldn't be held accountable to making a $3.3 million game. Because it's weird, like that demand for like people, there are people out there saying, you know, now you've got, even with the, what they did produce, they say, how is this a $3.3 million game? Because they don't know anything about budgets. And they would have got that, you know, in spades if it had been an hour long and, you know, only on one platform and something that you could make for $300,000. But if no one knew that it made $3.3 million, like, the outrage is artificial. It's not like one person paid $3.3 million. It's not like you as the customer paid, I can't believe I paid $3.3 million for this. I totally got ripped off. I would expect this kind of game if I paid $300,000. When in fact, you've paid the $18 that you would have paid regardless of how much the total was. Yeah. Like, that, there's no reason the customer really needs to know the total figure.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's probably best that they do, because in other cases, it could be, you know, it's good that project people are accountable to where they spent the money and have to explain that to some extent. And the more secrecy you have around how much money they actually have, the less that has to happen. And so it's probably a good thing that you do see the totals. But just in from their perspective, I bet it would be nice for them if they could just have the money and just not have anyone know how much money they made.
Yeah, there's certainly other people who went through Kickstarter that I can think of that would be the case as well. Anita Sarkeesian is obviously the one, you know, the number of people that complain about the amount that she got. Yeah. And then she just made some fucking YouTube videos. Ugh! You know, despite the fact that the Kickstarter project was to fund some YouTube videos, that she's making exactly what she said she would.
Yeah.
What was the other news? There was another game.
System Shock 3 has been announced, but it's not by, as far as I know, any of the team from either the System Shock games or Bioshock or anything. It's, what is it, Other Light? Is that the name of the studio?
I thought that was, though. That's Paul Neurath.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's Paul Neurath's studio, and he worked on System Shock 1, didn't he?
Oh, okay, I don't know anything.
I think he was like the, maybe like the co-lead or co-guy.
It's the same developer who's doing the remake, right, of System Shock 2?
Not exactly. So System Shock rights are now owned by, I think it's Night Dive or something like that, who are predominantly a publisher, and they are doing the remake, but it seems that they've licensed out the rights for the sequel to, what did you call them, Outer Light?
Other Light.
Other Light, yep, that's it. Who are, who's Paul Neurath Studio, Paul Neurath being a former Looking Glass developer who, and they're currently working on the kickstarted Ultima Underworld spiritual successor, which is called like Underworld Ascendant or something like that, because he worked on the original Ultima Underworld, and so now he's doing Underworld Ascendant, which he kickstarted last year, and now they've put up a countdown towards a reveal, which people now know is going to be System Shock 3 because it kind of leaked 5 days early. I think the counter on their website says there's still technically 4.5 days to go or something. But that's obviously not worked out for them. So they're the ones that are doing the sequel. And Paul Neurath was involved in either one or both of the previous System Shock games, as well as Ultima Underworld and a shit ton of other
It was
classics.
Somebody phrased it in a way that made it sound like the remake and this were by the same people. And I had read about the remake that Night Dive were... The thing they said about it was that, oh, we've been in close contact with some of the developers of the original System Shock, and so it was clear to me from that that they weren't the developers but I hadn't registered that there's a different studio doing System Shock 3. Huh. Okay, I'm excited now.
It's a confusing situation because it's not like... I can't even think of what... I think it's Night Dive. It's Night something, but I can't even think of what they've done before. Right. And now they apparently have the System Shock rights.
They bought it from an insurance company.
That's weird. But it's also presumably going to be crowdfunded because Night Dive aren't a big publisher. They're not going to just have tens of millions kicking around. And nor are... I've forgotten the name again. Other Light. You know, they had to kickstart their first project, and as far as I know, have never released a game so far, so they're not going to have the money just lying around. So presumably, it's a countdown towards them saying, hey, we're doing this. It'll be on Kickstarter next week. Mm. You know, something like that. Which makes me less excited, because I don't think anyone has ever kickstarted a project for a first-person shooter and had it actually turn out well, except for maybe little tiny indie things, you know. Sorry, You Were Being Hunted worked, okay, but people were trying to do spiritual successors to Rainbow Six games just turned out to be woefully short of any kind of budget that they would need to make that possible.
I guess you need like $100 million for...
Yeah, these games aren't expensive, and if you're going to do System Shock 3, isn't there going to be expectations of it being... Bioshockish. Well, also good. Yeah. But, you know, it can't look like System Shock 1 and 2 did. Right.
I wonder if it could look a lot like System Shock 2. Because that's a game, like the number of polys on the models and the resolution of the textures would need to be modern. But there's something very kind of clean and appealing about System Shock 2. I played it probably 2 years ago, which is recent enough. And it was still really nice to play. It's still kind of, its art style has its own charm. In the same way that I think that about Deus Ex as well. Like, those two games have not aged. Whereas System Shock 1, you go back to it and it's just fucking, oh my God, what am I looking at? It's just, like, not even from a sort of aesthetic taste point of view, but just in terms of, like, the interface just takes up 80% of the screen and there's no mouse look, and it's like a cursor that moving around the world. So that's just like from another era entirely, and it really suffers today. Whereas System Shock 2 is just a first-person game that, because it's set in a space station, it's okay that the environments are big boxes. And I mean, my expectations and hopes for it are along those lines. And I think of Bioshock was very much a kind of like, artgasm. It's like, we've got this really cool, unique, distinct place. We've got the really particular art style we're going for. We're going for this fantastic, monstrous creatures.
Yeah, they can't really
and
do
it's
that
all about that.
Station.
And it was all, it was kind of marketed on those. You know, the Big Daddy was a poster boy for the whole thing. and System Shock, I feel like, obviously Showdown is the poster girl for it. I'm increasingly uncomfortable with that word. But she's not anything that needs to be particularly well rendered. I don't know if I'm making any sense, really. But Bioshock,
I know what you mean.
Bioshock looks expensive, and you couldn't make a Bioshock game cheaply, but I feel like you could make a System Shock game cheaply. Not cheaply, but, you know, less than $100 million.
Do you feel like the ideas of System Shock have been adopted by other games in the same genre so much that it's difficult now to make a System Shock game that feels distinct? And especially with Shodan, who it just feels like if they, like, the defining most well-remembered thing about that game is a evil AI protagonist. And it feels like if they do an evil AI protagonist now, it's just, oh, God, another one.
I mean, I like what they... I actually don't know the plot of System Shock 1, but I know about it just from System Shock 2's kind of... You know, it's set after System Shock 1, and you keep hearing about what happened on Citadel, and you keep hearing about what Shodan did. And they really had some fun with Shodan's role in that, because she's not in it for like 5 hours or something, and then it's a bit of a twist when she shows up. But then even then, she's not the villain for a long time. She's battling this organic creation that she created a race of organic creatures, and they're kind of disgusting. And they're the main antagonists, and she's kind of battling with them, and you're helping her for a lot of the time. And so her role in it was very flexible and, I think, quite interesting up till the end. And so if they can do something like that again, you know, I think if it's built in the System Shock vein, that doesn't necessarily mean you are fighting a big evil AI who's trying to kill you. It could mean more interesting things involving her as a character who's more flexible. That was, like, in terms of a game, the thing that distinguishes System Shock 2 from, like, Bioshock and stuff is it was a much more of an RPG. It had, you know, stats that you leveled up. You had to put points into your strength and your agility and level up your ability to use weapons and stuff. And Bioshock kind of moved it all into shops, which was pretty similar in some ways, but, like, the tonics, the closest thing, I guess, it had to sort of passive stats that you're upgrading.
Bioshock, more like.
And so I don't know whether a modern take on Bioshock strips that stuff out because it's old-fashioned, or whether that's seen as the essence of System Shock. Mm. Sorry, did I say System Shock? Yeah. It is, other than that, like, Bioshock is very close to System Shock in terms of, like, its hub structure and how you kind of progress through these different distinct regions. And you know, in System Shock it was an elevator, and in Bioshock it was a bathysphere. There's just sort of direct analogs to so many things about that. One thing I'd really like to see him bring back is the sort of very lo-fi audio diaries. Like, audio diaries are a total cliche now, but they're sort of, these days, they're very high production affairs with actors doing acting on the audio diary. And in System Shock 2, that it's really nice, just everyday feel. They were just like emails from colleagues to other colleagues just saying, look, can you come down and fix this and whatever? And they were done, a lot of them were done just by the development team, like, not actors. And so they have this very naturalistic feel to them that's not at all like a performance. And I found that really convincing and got really into them.
You missed the opportunity for a Rainbow Six segue earlier there.
I did, but that's because I didn't want to name the particular game.
Yeah, that's what we've been playing this week, isn't it, Graham?
Rainbow Six Siege.
Which is obviously the sixth installment of the Rainbow franchise. And the story so far is obviously that Bungle has been radicalized following the death of George in a drone strike, and has joined an extremist cell, which Zippy is now infiltrating.
Yep.
It's pretty good. I love it, actually. I think it's an absolutely fantastic game wrapped in a big old bundle of shit.
Ubisoft! Put that on the box.
Yeah, actually, you play as one of the not totally awful things about it. Well, it is pretty awful, but I mean, like...
You said you play as one of the not totally awful things about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, talk about the game. It's not actually very much like a Rainbow Six game of generations past. It's much more like Counter-Strike, in that it's short rounds of two teams that are opposing each other, one inside a base or a building, guarding various different kinds of objectives, bombs in one case and hostages in another. The other team goes and raids the building and tries to neutralize the bomb and get away with the hostage. And it doesn't have any of the kind of things that you might think were traditional Rainbow Six things, like a strategy planning phase in advance. There's no cooperative AI part of the game, so you don't direct AI or plan waypoints for them. It's just multiplayer. Although there is a terrorist hunt mode in which you and human colleagues fight against AI terrorists. But that, in fact, is a really good analog for why the game as a whole is sabotaged, because Terrorist Hunt is the thing I was most looking forward to in that game. In some ways it works absolutely perfectly, but the way it's packaged completely destroys it. But we'll probably get to that later. To talk about the bit that I think is really good, I think they've made a truly amazing multiplayer game. And I think they do that by taking what would normally have been quite a tight and spare game mode. There's not a lot to, you know, in terms of the objectives. It's not kind of especially elaborate. And so you might imagine that you might play it like Counter-Strike with very few kind of vectors of attack, and it comes down to the kind of just mechanical brilliance of the players to kind of achieve victory or failure. But actually in this, what they've done is they've taken a lot of MOBA elements, not in the way that the maps are structured, but in terms of creating like a really unwieldy possibility space in which there's just a lot of possible things to do. And it, presumably at some point it will have like a meta like MOBAs do, and it will be solved, and then they'll keep on moving things forward so that it kind of it remains in this kind of chaotic equilibrium. And they achieve that equilibrium also with another MOBA idea, which is to have individualized characters. They're not quite classes, I don't think.
No.
But you can you pick different characters, and by picking one, you deny other people on your team access to that. The two sides are asymmetric as well. You can only pick certain characters to be defenders and only certain characters to be attackers. And they have, as well as having minor differences in kind of the number of bullets they can take, which is not many in any of the cases, they also have, they move at different speeds, but primarily they have quite different gadgets with them. Each one has a kind of gimmick.
Isn't the guy with the sledgehammer called Sledge?
He is, yes.
How did you get your name, Sledge?
Well, they all have exactly those kind of terrible names. Like, Smoke is a guy who lays down smoke. And Pulse is a guy who can detect heartbeats through walls. And there's a guy called Thatcher, who's just one of the SES team.
I would love it if there's just incidental dialogue throughout the entire thing, where just every now and then it's like, so Pulse, why do they call you that?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because there's almost no story to it whatsoever. And like in the promo videos for it as well, they were bigging up the appearance of a particular actress playing the president of the United States. She's in it for like 20 seconds. That what you saw in the promo video is her entire featuring in the game. She basically says, bad men are out there, go kill them. And that's it. And then you get introduction videos to each of the classes when you unlock them. But each of those is like 15 seconds long and crap. And, you know, it doesn't matter. It's really kind of cut down. There's no kind of over elaboration to it. But just in terms of the way that you can, one of the things I thought was worrying about, because I played it a bit in beta as well. And I think we were all kind of in two minds about it then. One of the things I was worried about is that it's heavily built around destruction, and I was worried that the more people would know the maps, the easier it would be just to kill people without having any line of sight or awareness of where they are, just simply by knowing that people usually come down this corridor at this time. And I found that a lot in the beta, but not very much now. I don't know if I've got better at it, or whether they've changed things about the materials and you know what bullets can pass through and where those walls are.
The terrorists inside have like a sort of a phase to set up, right, where they can kind of put barriers up and sort of decide where in the house they're gonna hole up.
Yeah, I think if you play it in ranked, you get more decision making around that. You can actually say which rooms you want to be in if you're playing it unranked, because you have to grind into your level 20 before you can unlock ranked. If you play it unranked, then you get the rooms chosen for you where you have to defend.
Right.
But yeah, so the defenders have a lot of different tools. All of them can reinforce walls. All of them can barricade windows and doorways. But barricades can easily be broken down or blown up. Now, reinforced walls can't be shot through or broken except by one particular character who can place thermal charges. No, he's called Thermite.
Okay.
Because he places thermite charges.
How'd you get your name, Thermite?
So once you've done all this setting up, you can kind of essentially lock down the different sight lines and different ways of entry. But the problem I think I was finding in the beta is that one of the levels in the beta was called Tubular Assault, which is one of the stupidest names ever. I kind of hope it is actually kind of legit kind of special forces terminology for assaulting a plane, a tubular assault. But I mean, the name kind of gives away the problem in that it's pretty linear and, obviously, it doesn't take a terrorist a lot, you know, it doesn't take them a lot of thought to work out that they're probably going to be coming from one of
two
directions.
From the only place they can come from.
Yeah. But
can you rappel out on the outside of the plane and breach into windows?
No.
tiny windows. Really slowly.
Hang on, dog.
Give it a sec.
No, you can't do that. There are lots of ways into it, though, and there are three stories to it. So, The plane is now segmented by, I don't know if this is an improvement or just my perception of it, but it's now segmented by unbreakable walls that actually do make it trickier for people just to shoot down a corridor and hit something instantly. But that level is one of the weaker ones, I think, because it does rely on just creating very, very long sight lines some of the time. But there are tactics to, you know, to get around that, I think, that weren't apparent to me when I was playing it briefly in the beta. And a lot of the other levels are very kind of complex building structures with very, very strange interiors. almost almost kind of elaborate to the point where I'm not really able to remember them, which is unusual because I
House
do
of
actually
Leaves
quite
siege.
That would be fantastic. I do have quite a good spatial memory though, so it's not that often that I get completely turned around in games. But these environments are quite difficult to just keep in your head at all times. But what that means is that you're really not sure where people are coming from or going to, and you rely so much on hearing. And the game has probably the best sound design I think I've heard in a game, where you're listening to footsteps and you can, you know, the kind of, you're trying to work out what surface the footsteps are being made on, how far away that, you know, where they're coming from. You hear glass shattering. You're like, don't know where that is. And gunshots sound very different depending where they are in the building, how many walls you're hearing them through, and, you know, the kind of environment that they're resounding in. I don't think I've had that experience where in a game of this sort, and I play quite a lot of these sort of tactical games, I don't think I've had this experience where everybody's just being quiet, just standing deadly still, trying to hear where people are coming in from. And that's just so exciting and thrilling, I think. And you've been playing some of this, right?
Yeah, I played quite a bit in the betas. They ran 3 or 4 over the course of development. And then since launch, I've been playing the terrorist hunt mode. Oh. And I think maybe I properly love the game.
It's a strange tone of voice to say that.
Yeah. But, so like I played Counter-Strike obsessively as a teenager, and I played it from some of the early betas. And as it went along, the game was constantly changing in response to player feedback. But through development, there were these kind of sub-games. Like Counter-Strike was never just one fixed thing. It was constantly changing. There were IDs that would be added and then removed. And the experiences I preferred in it were asymmetric experience. So Assault or Militia, which are two maps where the terrorists are inside a quite entrenched position, either a warehouse or a house, and the counter-terrorists have to make their way inside. And it created this asymmetric scenario. And both of those were hostage rescues as well, rather than defuse, which I always found much more interesting than the route that Counter-Strike eventually went down, which was the kind of defined by Dust, the defuse map, which became the most popular, in that it had kind of three routes, each of which were of equal value and strength, and where you met the enemy team at various choke points in the middle of those. And it was a much, much faster and a much more free-flowing game, and sometimes more immediate. Whereas I found the kind of the narrative of being like the underdog because you're the counter-terrorist trying to breach in, and the drama of you get as far as getting the hostages and now you're trying to sneak your way out and you've got to go quite carefully because you're vulnerable because you've got these three idiots following behind you who can't use ladders and, you know.
Don't you carry them in CSGO now?
I think you do, yeah. I think you throw them over your shoulder in a fireman's lift, yeah.
You kind of just walk them behind you in Siege.
All right.
That was always really exciting to me, but then Counter-Strike kind of moved away from that because it was less popular, which I can't begrudge it for, but it was like the bits of the game which I liked most are still sort of there. Like they port Assault and Militia eventually to every version of the game they make, but it's difficult to get a game of them sometimes because just no one's playing them. And Siege feels to me like someone has made the game for this small 10% of the Counter-Strike audience.
Don't tell yourself like that. We're mortified. What? We did?
And the flip
you
of
made
it
the
is,
unpopular Counter-Strike.
The flip of it, the other part of it is that it's doing a bunch of other things I wanted. So Battlefield games through Bad Company to Battlefield 3 used to brag about their destructive potential, and that destructive potential was always that after a certain amount of damage or a certain amount of gunfire, a building could collapse, and that would, you know, lead to these dramatic moments, which Battlefield 4 I think eventually codified with the Levolution, where, you know, skyscrapers could fall down.
I was trying to think of what the awful Levolutions was.
But it's really prescriptive in those games, isn't it?
Yeah, and it could create dramatic moments, especially in Bad Company 2 or Battlefield 3 to a certain extent, where you could be on the roof of a building that would start to collapse and you would have to parachute off the side, and that was quite fun.
I saw a GIF recently where, I'm not sure which Battlefield it was from, but someone jumps out of a jet, shoots another jet with an RPG in midair, and then is falling towards a building, shoots the building with an RPG, which blows open the side of the building, lands on the second floor with apparently no fall damage and kills 3 people inside.
See, that sounds pretty cool. But It was always, as you say, prescriptive, and it was always about the macro scale. It was always about, hey, isn't this, you know, a great spectacle?
Yeah, whereas tactics,
what I always wanted was just to fire a bullet and for the bullet to make a little hole, and now I can see through that little hole. And you could never really do that in any of the Battlefield games, but in Siege you can.
It's all about that.
And it's, an entire game about that, and it's the most incredible bit of tech, as far as I could tell. Like, this is sort of what Red Faction was promising in like 2000, but Red Faction would only ever take giant globs out of, you know,
this
walls.
Is like you can smash everything. You go into this pristine office, and by the time the game's ended, it has been shredded. Like, you know, all the monitors are smashed in half, everything's hanging off, paper all over the floor.
Yep.
It's great.
Adam at RPS said it reminded him of the original Fear. And yeah, it does have that of just like office spaces being shredded as you just pound it to death with bullets. But it also makes for a really fascinating, as you said, tactical, asymmetric multiplayer experience where line of sight is no longer everything and positioning matters all the more because it's about, you know, entrenched positions and where you can hear the enemies are coming from and that sort of stuff. And not only knowing what your line of sight out of this room is, but knowing that space over there is destructible, that bit over there is reinforced. If I hear this noise, that means they're directly below me right now. You need much better spatial awareness, and it's great. The other game that I really love was Rainbow Six games, particularly the Terrorist Hunt mode, which you and I, Tom, played a whole bunch of through Rainbow Six Vegas and Rainbow Six Vegas 2.
Murder Town Dark was the level that we would just get our asses kicked on. Because it was like Murder Town, but it was dark.
I'm pretty sure there's Murder Town in Siege.
Really?
I think they've ported it. In fact, it
might have been Murder Town.
might have been a pre-order bonus or something like that, but I'm fairly sure I've got it. And it was just a brilliant mode. Like, Rainbow Six Vegas and its sequel were not brilliant games, but it was great in co-op, and it was especially great in Terrorist Hunt mode because, again, it's asymmetric. And it was in Rainbow Six Vegas, the closest you could get to that experience of there's just a bunch of fucking terrorists in this building and we have to breach and clear and we're really vulnerable and we need to sneak through and they're in these entrenched positions and have good line of sight on us and we don't know where they're going to be. And Terrorist Hunt mode in Siege totally recreates that, but now with the ability to shoot through walls and blow the doors off buildings. And so I played it a bunch with Adam from RPS when he was reviewing it to help him out and because I wanted to have fun. And it was just great. There's two modes. So there's Terrorist Hunt Classic, which works just like the Vegas modes do, where you're trying to...
There might be three modes.
Okay, well, I've only played two. There's Terrorist Hunt Classic, where there's just a bunch of terrorists. They're in buildings, and you have to breach and clear them all out. And once you've killed them all, you win.
You look at each other and say, that was a classic terrorist.
And there's... there's some sort of, I don't know what it's called, some sort of bomb mode where there is...
Bomb defusal, I think.
All right, bomb defusal.
If you say so, Mr. Fancy Pants.
Where'd you get your name, bomb defusal?
maybe there's four modes.
We'll come to that. Where there's just, it's the same setup, there are the same similar sorts of buildings, sometimes just the same levels, but there are one or two, or I think maybe even three bombs somewhere inside the structures, and you have to fight your way to those and then plant down a device which diffuses those bombs, and you need to diffuse all the bombs in order to win. And I don't like that quite as much because it fakes certain parts of the experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So once you plant down the device to start diffusing the bomb, it spawns a bunch of guys outside the door. But I just want every first-person shooter now to have this tech, because there are moments in this game when I was playing it with Adam where there are these hazmat-suited guys, I think they're called.
The bombers.
The bombers.
Yes. Because they wear explosive vests.
Yeah.
They detonate themselves when they get close to you.
Yeah, or if they take too much damage. And they smash down these wooden doors. And so they come through like... They take a lot of bullets to go down as well, much more than anyone else. So they come through like they're a monster from Left 4 Dead. I want Left 4 Dead 3 in this engine with zombies smashing their way through walls and through office furniture and destroying stuff, because there is just these things and these explosive monsters bursting through.
I hate them. I hate them because although there are moments which are great which involve them, like when you see them coming from a distance, right, then... The panic that they inevitably cause, and the fact that you have to abandon whatever you're doing at the moment to change your focus upon them, that's an exciting and a legit moment of drama. But as often, you just turn a corner and you're dead. And it's like the game's just gone, reboot, sorry, do it again.
I agree with
that. And that's no fun at all whatsoever. And I think that's also true of some of the, like, if you miss a bomb, if you miss one of the kind of trip mine explosive booby trap whatever's, I don't know why I offered so many synonyms there. You know what I'm talking about, right? They explode.
Yeah,
why I've done that a lot. Explosive bombs.
The thing is, though, they, like, the hazmat guys, they're moving, and so sometimes you do just round a corner, and that's fucking bullshit. Yeah. But the bombs are flashing red lights that beep as you get near, and I still die to them so many times. I'm like, I can hear a bomb. And then just, nope, not going to look around for where it is, not going to do anything about it, just going to keep walking where I'm walking.
Sometimes there's other noises happening, like gunfire and stuff. But, I mean, the thing is, again, they aren't, it's not like they're a particularly great mental challenge to defuse. Like you say, they're obvious when you see them. But if you miss one and you die to it, it never feels good. It just feels like, oh, that was rubbish. That was a shit experience. And I'd really like to be able to play Terrorist Hunt and turn off bomb dudes and turn off booby traps and not have to do the hostage missions and the bomb defusal missions and simply play the, you know, terrorist, there are a bunch of terrorists in this building, kill them mode. And I'm pretty sure in previous Rainbow Sixes, you had quite a lot of ability to modify that and change it to your spec. I think you could even change the number of enemies down to the, you know, actual digits. And you can't do any of that in this. You can only do matchmaking. And you're not playing against another team. It's matchmaking you with a game that is on your computer that you've paid for. And it's saying, no, you will do this mode. And then after you've done that mode, you'll do this mode. And the reason it's so dictatorial about it is because you earn fucking gold for it. And it's because what your 60, 50 pounds worth has bought you is a free-to-play game in every other way. Like, it has a full free-to-play economy in it. There's nothing in the game apart from cosmetics that you can't grind for, but you will fucking grind for them. And it's dismaying to me that... I mean, aside from the fact that features are withheld from you artificially in order to make you grind for them, the fact that this economy exists at all has prohibited them from offering you just a custom game mode, which you can play as you like, because they don't want people to exploit it for the purpose of gaining gold. And that feels ludicrous to me. And that's kind of an emblem of everything else that has gone wrong with this game that I otherwise totally love. Like the fact that, you know, you have to, I mean, if you really want to earn characters at any particular rate, you have to buy a booster pack with real money. Though you do get some money up front, because of the way that characters are denied to you if other people pick them, even if you've bought, say, you know, even if you've bought four characters, there's a really good chance that all of those will be unavailable to you on any given match, and you have to play as the default dude who doesn't have any abilities.
Oh, really? Is that there's a guy with no powers?
Yeah, he's just called.
What's his name?
He can pass. He can stick like explosive breaches on walls and stuff like that. He just doesn't have particular. Like, he has the default skills there.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Sure. So, I know he's not. Yeah. He's not completely worthless.
He can still breach.
What is his name?
Recruit.
David Recruit.
But I mean that feels kind of. Okay, fine. Look, I mean, the characters have special skills, so it's understandable. It's understandable that the game would drip feed those kind of features to you. But the fact that if you buy more than one character within a certain nation's special forces, the price for that goes way up. Okay. Every subsequent time. There's no reason for that in terms of gameplay to make it harder for you to buy those things. It's just to make you grind for it. And there's other shit as well. Like, you know, you can unlock different weapons for your guy, unlock components for those things, and obviously they do give people an advantage, and I'm fundamentally against the idea that experienced players get an extra bonus they get a grip which reduces significantly the recoil on their machine gun.
Oh, so like, you're winning a lot off. Perhaps you'd like an advantage.
I loathe that stuff so much, and I think you'd feel really irritated if you paid such a large amount of money for a game to find that it has this, it's withheld stuff from you just simply to make you bleed for it. And that's made kind of more poignant by the fact that the infrastructure that holds it together is pretty shitty. We've had loads of connection issues trying to play it. There's quite a lot of bugs in the game as it is. Like, I had an amazing bug where I tried to climb a wall and somehow my character my character's head got stuck in the upside down pose that you have when you're kind of rappelling upside down, and yet my feet were still on the ground. I was looking back down at my feet and kind of under my legs. It was very strange. All my controls were reversed, but that's kind of one of the better bugs to have, because a lot of the time the bug is that you can't connect to a match ever. And there's weird stuff like it will, even if you turn off your voice comms, it will still make you broadcast. It will still pick up your sound even if you turn it off. If you change the volume of that, it will change the global volume of your microphone across all things. So I don't know if that's a way of sabotaging you using external communication tools rather than the game's in-voice chat, but it's certainly irritating.
But doesn't the problem, like, with that stuff, the worst thing is that Uplay has its own set of settings for voice comms, for volume and for set your push to talk button and all that sort of stuff, and then Rainbow Six Siege just ignores it. So you set all your settings in Uplay where you find your party and you add your friend, and then you connect, and then nope, none of your settings have taken effect. You've got to go into Siege's settings and do the same fucking thing again. Adam and I just ended up using Skype in the end, just fuck it, this isn't working.
Do you not find it changed your Skype settings?
Yes, but we fiddled with them in order to return them, just like we had today. You and I with Call of Duty. Fuck all these games. But like, Siege breaks my heart a little bit, because there was a story, I think, on Kotaku where they wrote a post saying Rainbow Six Siege has fewer players on Steam right now than Borderlands 2, which came out like 6 years ago or something like that. Borderlands 2 is, in fairness, a pretty fucking popular game even now. But it doesn't look good for Rainbow Six Siege. And that was my sense before it came out. And Kotaku writing that story, me saying this now, makes it a self-fulfilling prophecy, because no one wants to spend £50 on a multiplayer game
that they might not
be able to get a game of in 3 months' time.
They rolled out the free-to-play mechanics right out of the gate, because they know they're going to have to turn it into a free-to-play game in 6 months' time or something. And that's dismaying. I mean, it's dismaying because it's really good, and it would be even better if it wasn't, hamstrung by all this free-to-play stuff.
The thing I'd say is I was playing as a recruit when I was playing it, and I still had shitloads of fun. And I think all of us should pile on Terrorist Hunt and play it together.
Although, you know, I really, really want them to take out those other modes or give me an option to say which modes I want to play.
I know, but they're not going to do that, and it's still lots of fun.
They could give you an non-XP mode. Okay. Right?
They might do that, but they're not any more likely to do it if we don't play it. Let's play it, because it's still good. Yeah. It's still really fun. And like, I honestly, Vegas 2's Terrorist Hunt was some of my favorite multiplayer ever. This to me is, even with all the bullshit, at least just as good and probably better because of the destructibility. So, well done, Ubisoft, I say.
I want to mention quickly, I want to talk about Just Cause 2 again, but first I want to mention, going to take a stab at the title. Let's see how close I come. Dr. Languskov, the Tiger, and the Terribly Cursed Emerald, a Whirlwind Heist.
I'm not sure about the doctor's name, but I think that's otherwise correct.
Excellent. Which is a free game on Steam by William Pugh, Jack DeKeat, who has been on this podcast before, and I want to say Dominic Johan and a bunch of other people whose names I know.
Dominic Johan is right. He's a really good illustrator.
And he was on the Super Game Jam thing that I was a part of. And it's a 20-minute piece, very much in the vein of Stanley Parable. William Pugh is a designer on Stanley Parable. It's actually really interesting to see this alongside Beginner's Guide, which is by Dave Reedon of the Stanley Parable, because both of them have clear elements from the Stanley Parable, but they go in sort of, it's like Stanley Parable's personality split, and this is the pure humor element, and Beginner's Guide is the introspective kind of intellectual element. And I was surprised to find it was actually Jack who wrote it and not William. So it doesn't have a writer in common with Stanley Parable, but it is very much the same kind of meta humor about video games, very witty. And the narrator is Simon Amstel, which is remarkable and crazy. I don't know why this game is free. I haven't figured that out yet.
No, it says it's a complimentary game. So maybe they're building something else and using this as a kind of promo tool.
Yeah, so it's a new company these guys have formed.
Crows.
Not my favorite name.
I think that's fantastic. I love that name.
It's just a pain in the ass to say. It's a very, very spoilable, so I won't say anything about what happens in it. But I found it very, very funny, and it's beautiful, and it's 20 minutes long and just right at that length. Hmm. And I just like laughed all the way through, just found it incredibly charming and
yeah, delightful. I think it's one of my favorite games of the year.
Wow.
But like that, and actually that and the Beginner's Guide probably up there. I really enjoyed both of them. But this one's, yeah, it's very, very interesting to compare the two. I mean, they're both about, to some extent, how games are appreciated by people. You know, what part of it's performance, how they're structured, looking behind the scenes in both cases. And it's, yeah.
There's a fun thing in it, which, it's a game that responds to the things you do. So it's like, it's pretty linear, but within the rooms that it puts you in, when you behave in a crazy way, the Simon Amstel comments on it. And, two things were unusual, and just like there are loads of funny lines like that. And I had one instance where, like, twice you're sort of asked to do something at a particular time, and the first time I think I just did it because I wanted, I don't know, just like I was going along with things. And the next time I was asked to do something similar, I decided I'm just going to completely refuse. It's a really specific thing to build you up to how important it is. I'm just going to completely not do it, and then just continue to not do it. And Simon Amstel's prompts for you to do it get increasingly desperate, to the point where at one point he just kind of laughs at you. it's a laugh of dismay. Like, I can't believe that you're still fucking this up. And but is also kind of entertained by it. I don't know if that was kind of like intentional or whether it was more like an improv thing. But it's a very strange experience in a game to have to be the one making someone else laugh, like making the game laugh. Like, you just played in a way that made the game laugh at you. And usually the rest of the game, I've been laughing at it because it's doing the jokes. And it's doubly weird because it's Simon Amstel, whose voice you know quite well.
I like the Beginner's Guide is all about games which are really obscure, and appreciating them and understanding what to do in them is often really difficult. And this is a game which so understands what players are going to be doing. Being able to build jokes about players not doing those things, you know, or doing them at the wrong time. And, you know, at every point in it, it's predicted exactly what players will do, mischievous beasts that they are.
There's a sort of central joke to it. And it's really, after you've played it, it's really worth reading the Steam reviews. Before you've played it, don't read the Steam reviews. Not because they're spoilers, but just because they will set your expectations wrong. But after you've played it, reading the Steam reviews is great because everyone plays along with the joke and it's so good. the main thing I've been playing is Just Cause 2, and I talked about it last week, but I'd only played like 2 hours at the time, and somewhat foolishly I talked about what other people's opinions of the final game were, and then talked about like how they could fix this and why do they keep making the same mistakes without actually having checked whether I agreed that they'd made those mistakes. And it turns out I don't. The criticisms of it were kind of that the world is just very empty and kind of bland, there's not much to do in it, and the progression system is fucked because you have to complete all of the sort of challenges in an area before you unlock the story missions. That was my impression of what people had said. I think I said that last week. That's not true. The story missions, I don't know what they're gated by, but you certainly don't have to do all the challenges. I think you have to liberate certain regions, and liberating a region, the game is like one massive island and two small archipelagos, and those three places are the three regions. Each region is split up into provinces, and then each province is split up into settlements, and a settlement will be either a village or a military base. And if it's a village, it's got a bunch of propaganda equipment and you've got to break all that stuff. And if it's a military base, it's got a bunch of like power things and gas tanks and you've got to blow all those up. And those are really the only two types of things. But it's much more gamey than I realized. I can't remember anything about Just Cause 2 except what the world looked like and tethering stuff and things. I remember blowing things up. I don't remember why I was doing it or whether there was any challenge to it or what it got me or anything. But in this game, the blowing things up is much more gamey than I realized. It's very much a kind of almost a puzzle. It's a loose and open-ended puzzle that you can, one thing you could do is just fire an assault rifle at everything. And if you do that well enough and dodge the enemy fire well enough, you could eventually do it that way. But in a village, it's very much about like, there's these speakers with, blasting out propaganda. There's a van going around blasting out propaganda. There's statues, there's billboards, but there's also guards everywhere. And you can walk around freely, your guards won't attack you. But obviously if you destroy any of these things, then they will, go after you if you're in their vision at the time, and it has a little indicator on screen telling you whether you're watched or not. And so these become like guerrilla operations where you have to kind of set up like plant explosives or tethers without the guard seeing, and then back off and trigger them remotely and then destroy those things without being detected.
That sounds great.
So you can take out a whole village without ever alerting the authorities. And in fact, I did one earlier today where I swooped in on my parachute, and it was a tiny, tiny village on the coast. Beautiful. The whole game is gorgeous. Like the place it said is gorgeous. And I could tell there was only like, I think, one speaker pole and two billboards, and that was it. And so as I was drifting by, I tied the top of the speaker pole to the ground. I tied both of the billboards to the ground, because you can do multiple tethers now, and then just pressed the trigger to retract all my tethers, like make them pull towards each other, and it just pulled down all of the government equipment in the village all at once and liberated it in one go. But then there's a capital city, and that has a huge amount of different stuff and about four different captains you've got to assassinate to liberate it. And again, you can sort of take your time to set up those assassinations. I did things like, I'm a real terrorist in this game. I'm not the good guy at all, because as well as blowing up water towers, which you do in this game, just like in Just Cause 2, which is not at all good. There's no positive side to blowing up water tower ever. There's no evil water towers. I also plant explosives on the ground near civilians, in the hope that the captain will walk by it at some point, and then I can trigger it and kill him without alerting the authorities. Because as long as no one sees me plant it, and as long as no one sees me pull the trigger, I can get away with it. And if that means killing some civilians, well, you know, you've got to break some eggs. So that's the villages. And then the military bases also have a bit of a puzzly element to them, because they're hostile zones. So if you walk in, you're going to be attacked no matter what. And in fact, no one even needs to see you. So if you just walk in, and no one sees you at all, it will still say combat zone. And that means no one will necessarily come for you, but you can't lose heat. And there are rules about like how much attention you get for doing that and stuff like that. So it's definitely not a stealth game. And there's even the indicator of whether you're being watched by the authorities is frequently wrong. It's not well designed for that. And military bases, it's really not about stealth. You're going to go in there, you're going to be detected no matter what. And the challenge there is there's just a huge amount of stuff to destroy. There's just, it's all really easy to destroy. Almost everything can be destroyed with just like a single clip from your main weapon, or one grenade, or some explosives you can get close. And then every now and then there's a massive thing, like a huge tower or a massive satellite dish. But the puzzly part of it is kind of that, because there's so much stuff to destroy, you're going to run out of ammo. You can only really have, you have one special weapon, one like assault rifle type thing, and your normal pistols. You have infinite C4, but it's very difficult to plant C4 and stuff when you're being shot at, because, you know, being shot at, it takes a long time. And, so really the puzzle is about, there's all these elements around in the base that can help you destroy the base. Like, they'll just be tanks. One I did recently, there was just like six tanks parked in like a parking lot. And so any one of those, all vehicles have any kind of weapon, have infinite ammo for that weapon. If you get a helicopter with missile launchers, there's one helicopter that has like a minigun that can, you know, destroy pretty much anything with sustained fire. The next helicopter up has a minigun and rockets, both of which are infinite, both of which you can fire at the same time. The rockets are rapid fire and the minigun can destroy everything. Next one up from that has rapid fire rockets and then mega rockets that can like just nuke whole areas. And that's also infinite. And so it's kind of a game about like, figuring out, how do I get hold of, I want the helicopter, that's the one with the two types of missiles that can completely obliterate anything, but there's a SAM site right next to it. And so if I take it and take off, the SAM site will shoot at me. But if I can get to the SAM site, I can hack it. But if people are shooting me while I'm hacking it, it'll interrupt the hack, so I need to take out all the people nearby. And I can come in and do that and be attacked, but then more reinforcements will come in and helicopters will come in, and because I haven't hacked the SAM site, it's not on my side, so it won't defend me, and the helicopter will shoot me. So then maybe I want to call in a sniper rifle and then go up to like a nearby cliff outside of the combat zone and snipe people so that there's too few people around there so that I can then zoom in, hack the SAM site. Once the SAM site's on my side, I can take the helicopter. They'll call in other helicopters, but then SAM site will now shoot down the enemy helicopters and stuff like that. And that's just really satisfying. It's like, it's not, that's about it, what I've said. Right. That's about all the mechanics the game has. But it's like just enough, because it's also quite satisfying to do that and then have it tell you, you've liberated this region, you've done everything, you've destroyed all the government stuff, it's now liberated. If it's a town, they set up fireworks and they play a little tune on the guitar.
Thanks for killing our civilians. We've made a lovely omelette for you, Hillary Ben.
Thanks for destroying that water tower that was oppressing us in some way. And I usually, there's nothing to do at that point. So as soon as I raise the flag and everyone's celebrating and setting off fireworks, I'm zooming off my parachute and I just hear the sounds of celebration like fading in the background behind me as I zoom off to my next settlement to liberate. And that's great. And
So that's quite satisfying. And then obviously, like, you know, there's four settlements in this region, you liberate those, then you've won the region, or sorry, the province. And then you liberate these eight provinces and now you've won the region. And it's just very methodical and just very nice to kind of, it's this huge, beautiful open world with distinct areas and fantastic rock formations and beautiful places to wingsuit through. And what you're actually doing is repetitive, but there's just enough game there that it's kind of engaging for me. And it's, so it's just a very kind of addictive loop. The one thing I said last time on the native column that is true is still is that it tries to connect to Square Enix's servers all the time. And if it can't, it interrupts you and says, cannot connect to Square Enix's servers to log your fucking high scores. Like, it's not multiplayer at all. And it's not even DRM. Like, it feels like DRM because it's like an always online bullshit thing. But if you're just offline completely, it's fine with that. You just have to, you have to be actually offline or set Steam to offline because the game itself, it will say, oh, I can't connect to your servers. Do you want to try again or go into offline mode? So I'm like, okay, offline mode. And then 5 minutes later, we're like, I can't connect. It's like, what did I just fucking tell you about offline mode? Its own offline mode doesn't exist really. It just kind of, it just means for now, I'll let you go. But then I'm going to interrupt you in a minute to tell you that this guy just beat your record for running in a straight line whilst holding an assault rifle on a Tuesday. It has like a million different high score tables. Like everything you're doing, it constantly tell you, oh, like, Phil Savage just beat you at this. He's better than you. Driving along a car whilst next to a yellow thing and also holding three grenades.
John reviewed this for us at RPS and he messaged me at one point to say, who's this Phil Savage guy? he's obviously he's got him on like Steam friends list or something.
Yeah, Phil's got a lot of records. I think I'm in the lead for furthest distance traveled in a boat on land. For me, is like the crowning jewel of the high scores.
Was it Sleeping Dogs? It popped up with similar kind of achievements. So I remember I spent ages trying to. I think I was trying to beat Andy Kelly's target for just constant acceleration. I remember I got it and then I uninstalled the game.
It's another Square Enix game, isn't it?
Yeah.
The one thing that is bullshit about the progression system is that plot progress is not tied to the challenges. Like the challenges are things like races and wingsuit challenges and you know, flying through rings in the air. But your gear upgrades are, and some of them are just kind of like tether strength. There's no situation where I want my tethers to be weak. Like the whole game is about tying shit together. I need that to work. And when that doesn't work, it's not fun or interesting or cool or anything. I just want that automatically unlocked. And unfortunately, actually the tether ones are all right because the challenge you have to do for that, it's the same challenge every time, is get in a car, strap a like magnet to the back of it and then drive around a scrapyard collecting minerals on the magnet and then driving them to a hole that you ditch them in, and that gets you points. And if you do enough of those challenges, you unlock all the tether upgrades. Because that involves a tether in some way. You did have to tether a thing to a thing, so therefore that's the skill that you should be tested on to get these upgrades. Luckily, those are really easy. But then all of the wingsuit stuff and all of the kind of grappling around the world, like where you latch onto stuff, the upgrades for all that are tied to wingsuit challenges. And they are things where they take you up in a helicopter, they drop you really high, and then you have to fly through these rings, and you have to fly through the dead center of them to get the most points. And I like the wingsuit a lot, unless I'm being tested on it. And it's telling me, fly here, and then fly here, and then fly here. And then if you even slightly fuck up any of these, if you ever leave wingsuit mode, it insta-fails the challenge, and you have to restart the whole thing. There's no ability to recover at all. So if you even, like, brush any of the scenery at all, even if you could totally recover it and you'd be fine for time, it just fails the challenge, and you have to start the whole thing again. And particularly, you know, you don't have the wingsuit upgrades. You haven't been using the wingsuit a huge amount. You don't really know the rules of it, and doing these challenges before you properly understand the wingsuit is just an exercise in utter frustration. It's the most anger I've been at a game. The last time I threw a controller at something was about 4 years ago. And that happened again. But since then, so I've actually been using a series of trainers, cheats, and mods to try and get these things via other methods. There's a trainer that unlocks all of the wingsuit mod, all of the mods in general, and you just choose which ones you want in game. But a trainer is a thing you have to run concurrently with the program, and they're always a little bit seedy and dodgy. And, not super great. Then there was someone had sort of uploaded a particular file from their profile that you could overwrite your profile with to unlock all the wingsuit and tether mods. I tried that, but then it seemed to undo some of my other mods that I wanted from the other categories. And eventually I realized, like, this is ridiculous. I'm just going to get all the fucking gears for all the fucking wingsuit challenges. And to overcome my frustration with it, if I fail, then I just stop and I move on to a different wingsuit challenge no matter what. I'm never doing that again. So my first attempt is my only attempt, and there's no kind of repetition. So there's no, like, ah, I've got to do that whole thing again, because I'm just not going to do it again. So I failed. I only got one of the 5 stars or whatever. I'm just moving the fuck on with my life. And I did that. I just went around all of the different ones that I had access to, which is like 12 of them, and doing mediocre at 12 of them is enough to get you all the cool things. But also during the process, I sort of accidentally became really good at it and started getting max ratings and all these, and then started to kind of enjoy it. And I'm like, oh, fuck.
I've become the thing I hate.
Yeah, in some cases.
I've become the wingsuit man I hate.
I've become the winged idiot I hate. And yeah, the wingsuit is kind of awesome. It's a real, like, risk-reward thing where it's incredibly fast. It's absurdly fast. Like, cars are pathetic in this game. You'd never take, like, even the fastest sports car, even if there's a road going directly between you and a destination, you'd never take a car. It's absurdly slow. It's like jet planes, helicopters, and you, and then speedboats and cars below that. And so it's super fast, but you sort of eventually, after about 5 kilometers, you run out of height. And particularly if you're going uphill or anything, you're going to run out of height relative to the ground. But you can sling onto the ground as you can with the parachute. With the parachute, the parachute is amazing at that, and it's sort of designed for, you pull yourself towards the ground and the parachute magically turns that into upward velocity. And you can, like, at a cliff face, you can shoot your grappling hook into the cliff face, pull yourself towards the cliff, and activate your parachute, and you'll just shoot vertically up, like, 400 meters without colliding with the cliff at all. You just kind of slide gently against it. And the wingsuit has totally different physics, where if you touch anything in the wingsuit, you've hit it, and you ragdoll, and you take a load of damage, even if you hit it really gently. And but if you swoop close to the ground, like, once you go from the, like, 5 feet off the ground to about 3 feet off the ground, you get this kind of rush of air. Like, the air is kind of bouncing off the ground, and you get a huge boost of speed, and you can use that to angle yourself back up again and get a little bit of extra distance. But it's not enough to, like, keep you going indefinitely. So if you want to go indefinitely, you have to pull yourself towards the ground. And that challenge is, at first, I just never did that because it's pulling myself towards the ground, and that's often ended in predictable failure. But then once you get the hang of it, I started to, you can get amazing speed if you do it right. And if you manage to avoid the ground, basically you just pull yourself towards the ground and then hold up so that you get as much height as you can. That's not the best way to do it. The best way to do it is not quite hold up all of the time. So you get loads and loads of forward velocity, but then hold up just enough to not hit the ground and then get that extra speed boost from going near the ground and all that stuff. Then I got kind of hooked on that. And then it takes a certain amount of skill to really do that over all types of terrain, like even going uphill and stuff. And I don't have that skill. And so I'm just, like, slamming myself into the ground every single time. And then when I was doing these wingsuit challenges, I learned that almost all of them are doable with perfect rating without slinging onto the ground. Like, you feel like you're going to hit the ground, but actually you get that extra speed boost and you can pick yourself up. And so, like, there's a real art to it. And I've been going back and forth on how much slinging to do and when to do it. And I still get the judgment wrong sometimes and think, I can go over that crest. It's only a little way. It's only like 30 degrees. And as long as I latch onto the very top of it, then I'm not pulling directly down. I'm kind of pulling forwards and then just smack my face into the rock and spiral. The great thing is, like, after a few seconds of ragdoll, you regain the ability not to wingsuit, and I don't think to parachute, but you can grapple. So while you're spinning through the air, like, bruised and the screen's red, if you can also move the cursor to some bit of grapplable terrain, you can pull towards that. And then as soon as you're grappling, all of your abilities are enabled again. And one of those is wingsuit. So you can just, like, smack your face, spiral through the air, grapple onto something new, and then wingsuit again. And be like, yeah, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. It's quite a good game.
Huh. I want to play this game now.
Shall we do questions?
Yes, let us do the questions that we have that I'm trying to read somehow.
Marsh's mic is in his face, and so the paper of the questions is behind the mic.
Mr. Skelly says, greetings, Crate and Crowbar. I know it doesn't show, but the amount of effort I put into coming up with a pun and then deciding just to just go with a standard header deserves some form of recognition.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
I deserve recognition for giving up.
Anyways, lately, he says, I've been enjoying co-op action romp that is Warhammer Vermintide. As some of you already played it, you're keenly aware that it belongs quite firmly in the Left 4 Dead cooperative death run battle of attrition against special bad guys hiding among the hordes of standard bad guys while your verbose allies without microphones run off on their own and die like the nitwits that they are, camp. One can't help but draw a comparison between the two, considering their mechanical similarities, and yet I'm completely delighted with Vermintide as a cooperative gaming experience, whereas playing Left 4 Dead has always been like taking a bitter pill. I've examined my experience between the two games and come to the conclusion that this difference of opinion between them is by no fault of one developer or the other, but just a matter of the flavour of atmosphere each game presents itself with. As an example, the Rat Ogre is almost identical to the tank in terms of what it presents... That sentence doesn't make sense. Of what it means in the game. A big stompy creature that is going to be loud, have lots of health, leap around and smash shit until your team manages to kill it. But my reaction to hearing a rat ogre roar is a fearless, fuck yes, let's do this, versus a tank's bellow, to which I quietly shit myself and try to put a couple of my buddies between me and him. Left 4 Dead is a horror game, and so I naturally feel dread when horror things happen. Vermintide is an action game, and I feel excitement when exciting things happen. Go figure. And so we finally reach the question. Are there any two games you've played that are mechanically nearly twins, but you found the experience of one far superior to the other? What made that difference so stark, Mr. Skelly?
I can't speak because I didn't like one of them, I can't speak authoritatively to how similar they actually are mechanically, but I have always been a huge fan of Dawn of War, and I suspect there is nothing mechanically about Company of Heroes that would prevent me from liking it. In fact, I suspect it's probably mechanically superior to Dawn of War, but I just can't get into World War II. I just find it not just uninteresting, but sort of actively boring. even given a cool game experience, if it's happening in the World War II setting, I'm sort of a net neutral. It'll counteract good things that are happening. And every now and then someone will talk about it. Brendan Chung was... I think did a whole podcast about it with Three Moves Ahead maybe recently, about those games, and listening to it, I'm happy to listen to people talk about how great it is, and every time they do I think, I should really play it, but every time I play it I'm just depressed again. I just find the theming so off-putting, whereas Dawn of War still often takes place in muddy fields and is about grenades blowing up debris and capturing points and stuff. But just because it's sci-fi, I'm automatically like, oh, this is cool. Cool things can happen in this world because it's magic sci-fi.
Yeah, it's weird. Actually, I was thinking about this recently because I realized I've developed more of a kind of weird history boner for war and war things. Which I would
history
have,
boner for war.
I know. I would have thought that was quite a sad thing in the past. You know, people who do kind of historical reenactments and stuff, I probably would have sneered at. But now I listen to a lot of kind of history podcasts and I get quite excited about
hardcore
reading.
History.
Yeah, hardcore history particularly. I think that may be what sparked
it's maybe a nerd for Genghis Khan for sure.
Oh yeah. But also I've just taken a much more greater interest in descriptions of battles and stuff since then, and I've gone back to, I've got lots of kind of history books around. I never particularly was super interested in that kind of war stuff, as opposed to other facts about the era. You know, like I've been interested in history generally, but you know, war has never been a particular fascination of mine. And now actually I am interested in the combat of battles, but there is an exception to this, and it is Stalingrad.
Just which, Stalingrad?
Well, I think...
We're a boner for everything except Stalingrad.
I think it's because I read Max Hastings' book on Stalingrad while I was hospitalized, and it was so depressing. It was easily the most depressing thing I think I've ever read, that it has kind of ruined World War II for me.
Oh, come on, Max, you just ruined World War II. It was such a pleasure before this.
But everything even kind of faintly World War II themed, or even World War I themed, I think just the modern era of warfare has been kind of drained of any potential interest as a result of that. I don't know, weird.
Emily Guerra tweeted a sort of ironic photo of a book on... like history's greatest naval blunders.
I know,
as a kind
I thought,
of joke about like, oh, look at this dull
thought,
thing
I'm
reading.
That sounds great.
And yeah, I had the same reaction. Like, oh, that sounds really interesting. I'd love to know about what the biggest naval blunders were.
I like that video games from a certain way just become a gateway to really other nerdy subgenres and things. You know, like you start off just liking video games and that's bad enough, and then you come out the other end of it and you're a history buff and you're really into trucking.
I think it's a good thing to get to do. I think they introduce you to, well, ways of understanding systems. And once you understand war as a system that the levers can be pulled within, then you begin to understand why generals did the things they did and why they are interesting and why they were significant. And suddenly, instead of being just a, you know, a cold list of deaths, it suddenly becomes, you know, a thing to which men's minds were put and and tested. And that becomes a much more kind of interesting thing to talk and think about. JR says, "Dear CNC, I don't understand this question, actually, I have to say. On a scale of from," and he puts it in inverted commas, "mercy play of the game to FY Rubik, how do your favourite team-based multiplayer games provide an interesting set of mechanics for supporting your team? I assume Rubik, I think, is a Dota character. I assume maybe he is a support character. I don't know. Anyway,
he's the one who can steal anyone's spell, I think.
Oh, okay. I suppose that is interesting. Well, anyway, basically his question is, how do games make supporting your team an interesting act? I think that's the core of it.
Graham did not support the team on this one.
I like first-person multiplayer shooters that make teamwork almost accidental, where it's encouraged through level design. For example, when we talked about Counter-Strike before, one of the great powers of Dust was that by just having two or three routes towards a central point, you always ended up funneled alongside your teammates, such that you quite by accident covered one another. And I also liked a multiplayer mod called Frontline Force. Did any of you play that?
No.
Half-Life? It's made by, I can't remember who it was made by, but he was hired by Valve right afterwards, and I think he's still there. But it had a mechanic whereby you got buffs and bonuses to the points that you were gaining for remaining within proximity range of your teammates. And that seemed like such a simple fix for a common problem in kind of team-based games where people split up and go off, which I've never really seen. I don't think I've ever seen any game copy it. I always liked that. And then, you know, well, that guy went on to work at Valve, so maybe it's just him, maybe it's good, but I really like the medic in Team Fortress 2.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of games that have healer classes in them, especially MMOs, and many first-person shooters since Team Fortress 2 have tried to have a medic class, and often they have like a hose gun, but they never quite work so well as I think the system that you have of the medic, of being able to charge up people to maximum health, but then be able to overcharge them if you do it for long enough.
It's really funny seeing that hose heal come up in just everything now. Like, because I remember Valve talking about inventing that thing. Not that they were the first people ever to do anything like that, but just their process of arriving at that was just, okay, we need this healing relationship, but we need it to be clear to everybody. And so what's the simplest way we can do that? We'll just draw a line between them and then, you know, styling that to look a bit bendy. and that's just become the industry standard. Everybody has that. We're like, we're
playing Heroes of the Storm as well. Hence that terrible dinosaur game that
we're that's what I was going to mention.
Like Guardians of Orion.
Random top-down survival game we're playing the other day. Well, if you're healing
not each terrible.
Other.
Maybe not terrible.
No, it was all right. but yeah, if you're healing someone, then a big glowy line, of course, connects the two of you. That's just standard now.
But I feel like the systems, like, it feels really nice. Like, other glowy lines don't look or feel so nice to wield. But I feel like the medic is a really satisfying change of pace to the rest of the game. I think the system of Ubers and overcharges is interesting.
But it's also, I mean, I think obviously there's a lot of why that's pleasurable is to do with the visual feedback that you get, which is so kind of transparent and beautiful. But also, the distance you need to be from a person and the kind of cooperation that you have with him, and the mutual understanding of your shared benefit is really key to why that's so good. Because you're essentially two parts of a pantomime horse in two. And, you know, if you play with tanks who just rush off, you can't really, it's not enjoyable. But once, I think because it's so obvious what's happening and the benefit is so large and clear, and it also provides such a massive, when it overcharges, like that's the biggest kind of power up in the game, that gives such an incentive for players not to just fuck around with the medic. They have to get a medic on their side. And so it kind of it requires a level of cooperation from both people. But for once in games, they're both willing to cooperate, which doesn't often happen when you're playing with randoms, I think.
I think it makes much more sense in Team Fortress 2 than it does in a lot of other games as well. Like, I've seen it be added to almost like military shooters, where even if they've got a sci-fi bent, they maybe don't have the other types of weapons that Team Fortress 2, like one, a big thing in Team Fortress 2 is knockback. When you get hit by a rocket, there's a splash damage that throws you into the air. And that means that staying within range of your heavy is much more interesting when they get blown off the ramparts and thrown 100 feet away by the turret that they just came face to face with and that sort of thing. Whereas, you know, you don't get that in other multiplayer games necessarily. And so it doesn't necessarily make sense as a weapon within the ecosystem of weapons that they've created.
I don't like the medic in TF2. Not because I have any like issues with, you know, how they represent healing or anything, but I'm not that interested in being a healer. I found that I didn't have any sort of like thing to get excited about, but I was a career medic in Battlefield 2 and 2142 as well. And in fact, I want to talk about this just because as a healer type thing, but also that has other things to do with supporting your team that are really good. But for me, the difference between the two medics in Battlefield 2 have a med kit, and if they stand near someone holding the med kit, it kind of generally heals people all over. You can also chuck them on the ground, and it's just a health kit that you pick up for an instant bonus. But none of that was interesting to me. I didn't really care. The thing I loved was the defibrillators. For me,
the
fun way to heal someone is to wait till they die and then bring them back. Because rushing out into the, like, when someone just got killed, the time limit to resurrect them is short-ish. And so in every single circumstance when you're resurrecting someone, they are in a situation where recently a person was killed here. That's like, not coincidentally, this is a dangerous zone. The place where someone is dead is a dangerous place to go. And so it's always a kind of courageous thing to rush out and save them. You're always risking your life. And hitting them with the defibrillators, you know, jolts them back to life. And that's very satisfying. And it's just this one singular action that has huge significance. It's literally saving a life. And there's never any doubt about whether you save their life or not. It's just completely binary. They are dead. If you save them, they come back to life and now they're alive again. Whereas sort of, you know, the constant stream of healing stuff is less kind of concrete and less exciting to me. I was like mad about saving people. I would save everybody I possibly could and I wouldn't care if I died in the process. But I was also frequently going off on my own, and there was just a little bit of a design flaw with the medic in BF2 where the unlock system meant that the assault rifle he unlocked was at least as good as the assault class's assault rifle, and it was amazing at long range. And it was basically a sniper rifle, but also an assault rifle if you needed it to be, and it was just fucking great. And you're a medic, so you have these med kits that they're there to like hold them and heal your team generally, or put them down to help heal someone who needs health. But you can always just drop them at your own feet. So I just drop two medkits at my own feet and sit on it and snipe people. And these snipers, unless you have the top of the line sniper rifle, it could only take down like 90% of your health. And so if you shoot me with a sniper rifle, you take off 90% of my health, but I instantly heal back to full because I'm standing on a medkit. And I can do that twice. And my rifle is nearly as accurate as yours, and I've got like 30 rounds per clip. And so I would just kill like four or five snipers in a row.
And I'd forgotten about the defibs in BF2, but I used to do the exact same thing. I feel like a lot of the appeal there is that it draws you out from cover for these hero moments where you just run across a battlefield, bullets pinging around you, explosions going off behind you and that kind of thing, which just feels fucking great.
The other thing I was going to say about Battlefield was it also had a really good way of tying squads together, and particularly 2142. I don't know how it progressed after that because I was less into Battlefield after 2142, but 2 and 2142 let you form squads, so you could just nominate yourself, I'm just going to start a new squad, or if there's other squads you can join them, and that's within your team. There's smaller groups of people because it might be 32 a side. You join a squad of like four people, and my calling in gaming life is to be a squad leader. That's just the right level of responsibility. I can handle like two or three guys are going to do what I say, and then everyone else is not going to do what I say, and then one other guy who's the commander is going to tell me what to do. And that's like, I'm a born middleman. It was just perfect because I would like there would be times when I'd do what the commander said, and he'd say, you need to take this point, and I would direct my guys to all come with me to take this point. And there'd be other times where he'd tell me to take a point, and I'm just like, no, man, it's suicide. There's three tanks there. I know there's this other point we can take. And I would just go and say, like, fuck the commander. We're going rogue. We're going to take this point. And two was pretty good at giving you points for, like, squad people could spawn on you as a squad leader. Like, if I'm still alive and the rest of my team have died, they can respawn where I am. So they're with me right away, rather than having to spawn at a nearby base and walk to me. So we're just stuck together naturally like that. And then 2142 was great because it gave you extra points for everything you did with your squad. So if you killed someone while you're near a squad mate, it was counted as like a team effort. And if you captured a point, because you mark orders for your squad on the map, you say, we're going to capture this point. If you actually do capture that point, you get twice as many points because you did what you said you were going to do. And so all your squad get extra points for it too. And so your score on the scoreboard is, you know, rocketing.
Hmm.
And that I did care about ranking a battlefield. I did really want to be high on the scoreboard because it meant more than just kills. It was like you worked together well. You did what you said you were going to do. You executed on your orders. And that was really satisfying.
Shortly after that, they pretty much just abandoned commanders for like two or three games. Like the Bad Company games never had commanders. I don't think Battlefield 3 did either.
Did they have squads?
They had squads. They maintained that all the way throughout, and you would always spawn with your squad leader and that sort of stuff. So they were still dead useful. But I think they only reintroduced commanders maybe with Battlefield 4. Might have been Battlefield 3, but certainly Bad Company, and I played a shitload of Bad Company too because it was just great. It downplayed. I'm just moving off the question now to talk about a game. It downplayed the vehicles a whole bunch, which meant that the maps were smaller, which didn't matter so much. But most importantly, they were more linear. So what it gave the kind of arc of a Battlefield match was the sense of progression that maybe you lost when it was just like a 6 kilometer by 6 kilometer squared with jets and planes and you know, all this
the thing you needed a commander for was to actually tell you which control point we're working on right now and make sure you're all focusing on the same one. Or
Bad Company 2's slightly more focus. Bad Company 2's slightly more constrained focus.
Right.
It's still a shitty sentence. Let them do what they did with Wake Island, for example, in 1942, was that it was just a giant corridor as an island, basically. You just moved linearly from one end to the other, and that created, you know, really interesting choke points and stuff. We're still having a little bit of vehicles in certain parts of the map.
Something kind of magical about Battlefield 2. I have such fond memories of it. The commander system was nuts at the time. Like, it was just a weird thing to do.
I think wasn't it like super ambitious. Building on a map that you had to get into to become the commander as well? On Gulf of Oman, I thought it was like a particular, like you could kill the enemy commander if you blew up their command post.
They were a real person on the field, and they would usually end up lying in a caravan or in a tiny corner because, you know, most of their time was spent on the map, but they also were a soldier with a class and they could do stuff.
Okay.
But it was more efficient often if they just stayed like hidden.
Jake says, "Dear great and subpar."
Wow.
Which is pretty good, I think. Yeah. That's a good one.
Surprised we haven't had that.
One of the many things that made Fallout so appealing to me was the amount of choice placed into dialogue. Ammo was always scarce. He's talking about Fallout 1, by the way, I guess. Ammo was always scarce and lockpicks were fleeting. The only thing I could reliably count on was my charming personality, leaving me with not much else to survive the wasteland. I was disappointed, however, when a few days into Fallout 4, I began to notice something. Persuasion always seemed to lead to a bigger payout or avoiding a fight entirely. And while those certainly have their benefits, it seems to be the only benefit presented from high charisma. I've been playing for a week or two now with a level 30-ish character, and it still seems like I'm seeing these same old solutions. New Vegas made a deep, interesting experience out of dialogue and speech checks, and it's a shame that Fallout 4 couldn't carry over some of that ingenuity. Don't you think of some ways that the game could be made better, could have made better use out of speech checks, or suggest other games that do dialogue similarly well to New Vegas? Love the podcast, Jake.
I really like, I assume New Vegas is the same system, but in Fallout 3, the thing I loved about the dialogue, the sort of bonus dialogue options, was that they weren't all about a charisma stat. If you had really high science and you're talking to a scientist, you'll get a science option that says, you know, science 50, you can say, hang on, shouldn't this robot be doing this? And can't you just switch that panel? And then the scientists will say, oh shit, you're right. And then just it will resolve the quest or something like that. And I love that thing about like, whatever's unique about my character, that will unlock dialogue options. I don't like dialogue being just this one stat. And if you put a bunch of points into the stat, then you're good at dialogue and that's it. It should be like, if my character's good at science and I'm in a situation where a scientist would be useful, then I'm useful.
Yeah.
There's an amazing, it was a video doing rounds on Reddit recently, as an example of pretty much what this guy is saying, that New Vegas had way better dialogue options than Fallout 4. And isn't it a shame that Fallout 4's persuasion system seems to be, as far as I've seen, the only thing I've ever seen is just like, one of the options will be in a different color. And if you use that, it means it's going to use your charisma skill. And it's just a dice roll as to whether it works or not. I much prefer like unlocking things for sure and saying, because I've got this stat to 60 level, then I automatically get this dialogue option. But anyway, the New Vegas thing that someone was linking as an example of why it was better than Fallout 4 for dialogue was that at the very end of the game, this is a spoiler for New Vegas, but I won't spoil like many specifics. The final confrontation, instead of a fight, you can talk to their boss and persuade them not to attack, basically. And it's a really long conversation. It's like, well, about 6 minutes. But in game terms, that's very long. And it's has multiple stages at which different speech levels unlock different options. And so there'll be one speech 70, continue the conversation this way. And the next thing you'll get is speech 80, continue the conversation this way. And if you don't have speech 100, you'll never get to the end of this thing. But if you have speech 100, then there's like four other options at the end of that where you keep talking about military strategy and how his plan is going to work. And you get into the nitty gritty of it. People were saying the voice acting was great. I don't think the voice acting was great. I thought it was incredibly dry.
Oh, that's terrible voice acting. What the fuck are people talking about?
And,
I didn't realize that was the context in which it was being.
But yeah, it was being linked as, I mean, basically the cool thing about it is you can just win with speech and you don't have to fight, which is cool. The actual conversation is pretty dull, if you ask me. And then at the end of it, after like 6 minutes of talking, you finally persuade the person. And then after they've, agreed that they're not going to attack, then they say, oh, maybe if there were more soldiers like you in the world, then we'd have a better place. And the conversation ends and they just sprint off screen like 100 miles an hour and then rush through a door and vanish. And that's the end of the game. And it's like this huge conversation. Obviously a lot of effort and work went into making work. And it's a cool thing that you can end the game that way, but just completely spoiled by run speed. Because the final moment is just someone like just vanishing off screen.
Yeah. I think people enjoy that dialogue presumably because they played it and they had stakes and they felt the tension of the choices that were being made. Whereas as a piece of drama, it's fucking dreck. It's total trash.
It's also, I don't know much about New Vegas, so I didn't get very far in it, but it's there's a Roman themed faction and he is part of it. And it's there's something about that is very false and silly. It just feels like you're in an amateur production of some movie or something.
And they Roman themed because they're based around the Caesar's Palace casino in Vegas or something like that.
Right.
So maybe it's deliberate that they're stagey and false because it's Vegas.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun idea, but there's no humor in this final thing. It's definitely serious military stuff.
I don't like conversation options when they feel like a reward, and that's what Bethesda games often do. Like, it feels like, hey, you've done lots of talking, so now your reward is you get an extra option that will just work guaranteed. You know, you've got speech level 100, therefore you can just choose that option reliably every time you get through. Much prefer there being some drama and tension in the idea that even if you do persuade that person, you might, you know, the outcome, like a genie in a bottle, might be different from what you intended.
Can you think of any games where there's a persuasion option and it's bad? Like you persuade them too much and they kill themselves or something?
There's Tenpenny Terrors in Fallout 3, where if you try and take the peaceful option and say, you know what, I'm going to abstain from violence here. You know, I don't want to get involved. And you try and make peace between them. I think they just all end up dead.
Yeah.
That's possibly spoilers.
I really like, for what you're saying about like conversation options not just being a reward and not just being an automatic solution, I think Deus Ex Human Revolution is really good for that. Like, it's, you have to really listen to what the person says and think about them and what they're like and what their personality is like and which option is going to appeal to them. It's all about playing them and working with their personality. Whereas other games, it's so, you get the dialogue options like, of course, you just say the virtuous, honest thing. And
yeah. It's the, succeeds where Oblivion failed so dramatically with its weird conversation wheel thing.
Oh, yeah. Pip was saying last week that she loves that. She wishes all conversation was just the dialogue.
I was
just the
persuasion
wheel.
Really good at that by the end of Oblivion.
Yeah, it was very satisfying once you got the knack of it.
Ding, 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 ding.
Until that conversation last week, I did not understand that. How that worked. And I played Oblivion for like 100 hours or more. I loved that game, but nope, never once understood how that fucking conversation would work. Just brute forced it, you know, leveled up my speech stat until I got, you know, until it didn't matter. Never work out why those fucking meters were changing.
I had no appreciation of what any of that, that pie chart meant in relation to what they were actually saying. I just clicked through the dialogue and instantly went for the bits of the pie that I wanted.
I'm going to butcher his joke now, but Chris Livingston said something great about, like, he was so pissed off at that system, he called up Bethesda and he tried to threaten them to make them change it, but then he also had to flatter them and make a joke.
Very good. Travis says, "Dear Warmonger Graham, how do you sleep at night?"
Very comfortably at the bottom of my ocean, at one of my many undersea outposts.
I guess Travis, as he signs off, aka Depth Sarge, is one of the people you annihilated in your triumphant playthrough of whatever the game is
Subterfuge.
Called.
didn't annihilate him.
Okay.
Credit to Mr. Sarge. He used his specialists well to come back. Even though I was much larger empire and did, yes, invade him with my many drillers. But he was the only person that I invaded, and I never made any promises to him. And one of his outposts was called Smith Rand. And when you think about it, shouldn't that really be mine? You know, I'm just repatriating my people.
Having addressed Graham directly, he then goes on, "Dear moral members of CNC, what's the strongest emotion you felt playing a game? Perhaps limit answers to those you believe the developer intended you to feel." With considerably more love, Travis.
I don't know, just like laughing counts as an emotion.
Yeah.
Because the end of Portal, I was just in hysterics because it's a boss fight. And the tension is rising. There's a time limit on what you got to do. But also, GLaDOS is kind of making increasingly absurd jokes as it goes along. And there was this perfect moment of like the humor hitting fever pitch right at the time that the mechanics did as well. And the mechanics weren't that interesting, but just the jokes were, it was stuff about like, the thing you just broke was the catalytic cracking unit. Made shoes for orphans. Nice job, hero. Yeah. And that was just, it kept going on, and I was kind of like in two minds as to whether even to finish the fight because I just wanted to hear more of what she was saying.
What's the other really funny game?
Portal 2? <You know, laughs>
That came out. No, it was an indie game, spy themed, looked a bit like one of...
Jazz Punk.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, that's another really funny game that achieves the punchlines it wants. And I also think that Doctor whatever the fuck it is and the fucking stuff Langus that is Golf. Also in the name, that's also really funny in the way that it achieves.
I guess.
Other emotions, though?
Yeah. I don't think it was Neptune's Pride, but in some games where sort of alliances can be formed fluidly, the feeling of being ganged up on is a really intense thing. Like the realization that actually everyone is trying to destroy you and they've... you know, formed an alliance against you. It's one of the reasons I don't play those games ever anymore is because there's something that like that emotion comes out of the game. And now you're thinking about the people and all the people have decided they like you a lot less than the other. Mm. They like each other. And now you're the only person. You're just like alone. That's horrible.
Do you think?
I don't think that's intended by the
audience. Yeah, that was the thing. Cause like, that's the reason I remember Neptune's Pride and really value it as a game.
I think, terrible feeling.
Yeah, was the feeling of guilt that it ended on in my playthrough. And I don't think, yeah, I think you're right. I don't think it was intended, but that was a pretty powerful experience. Mm. Unrepeatable. No desire to repeat that.
I've no desire to play it even once.
And no on regret. No regret at all about attacking Depth Sarge, though.
Gareth has written in with actually the longest letter that we've ever received, possibly the longest letter ever written by a human, which I have
taken some time over editing down to the page of text that I will now read. Hi, CNC crew. As my favourite pod people, I wanted to answer one of the questions from the other week about gaming for kids, especially referencing what to start them on. I deliberately raised my two girls to enjoy games. They have both been gaming in one way or another since they were 1 year old, and I have always made sure they benefit from it. In this time, I've done and noticed some very interesting things. He goes on to expand these bullet points, but I've deleted the expansions, so I'm only going to get the headlines. Kids who grow up with open world games often play very differently than old school gamers. That's one. You need to be involved in playing the games. Using games as a babysitter is a one way ticket to trouble. Minecraft is more amazing than you will ever realize. And then he goes on to say, from what I've seen from watching my girls play, games are definitely going to need to shift as the next generation comes up. It's going to need more character choice, presumably in order to account for the fact that there are girls playing in the first place. More open gameplay, e.g. multiplayer games with like private game option, because it gives kids time to learn safely. Also mods, he has three bullet points dedicated to mods. But I've summarized them here. I've tried them with all sorts of games, and the less options they have to play, the less likely they're there to be engaged. Co-op games should always have at least three players, presumably for two kids and a parent or three kids. More exploration spaces, like Lara Croft's Mansion. He wants LAN and internet private games rather than private groups and matchmaking. And he lists some awesome games that are already out there for kids. Minecraft, obviously. Starboard, which I wasn't aware of.
Not Starbound?
No. Well, he says Starboard. But maybe he means Starbound. That would make more sense. Actually, given the description that I think he had in the longer unedited email, that might make more sense. Anyway, Castle Crashers, Tomb Raider, which he qualifies saying, when they were very young, they didn't know that she had guns, and she was just swimming lady running around the house. Disney Infinity, Trove, Dungeon Defenders, and DC Universe. And he says, now my girls are 8 and 11. They love gaming and will often come top three in Titanfall public matches.
Wow.
I won't tell you the order lest I dent my male pride. But we always go back to the creative and playground games. I just thought it was quite an interesting kind of summary of people who have grown up with games and their kind of gaming life thus far for the last decade. I think that's it.
Yeah. I've just spent the weekend visiting family in Scotland, some of which was spent with my nephew, Noah, who's 4 years old now, and his parents have just been encouraging him to play, I think it's Super Mario 3D Land on the 3DS.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're trying to teach him perseverance. You know, he would play Skylanders on the Wii U and maybe some other games, but he's quick to, once he can't do a thing, if he fails once, to just say, oh, I can't do it. You do it for me. I can't do it. And so they've just been away for a month's holiday. And at the start of the month, he was terrible, apparently, at Super Mario 3D Land. And at the end of the month, he's damn near completed the game, as far as I can tell.
Really? Yeah, oh, wow.
I sat watching him yesterday. Uh-huh. Hop through these levels and defeat these Mario platforming challenges and that sort of stuff. He's unlocked Luigi. He's, you know, he's leaping over. He's given it to me occasionally to have a go, and then he's, you know, telling me this button that shoots the fireballs, press that button.
And did you say, I can't do this, you do it?
yes, he's much better at it than I am, that's for sure. You know, I would die, hand it to him, and he would defeat Bowser for me. He'd go past the boss.
I haven't played that one. I think the Mario games are great. Mario Galaxy and Mario Galaxy 2 are easily two of the best games of all time. But I don't know how good they would be for kids. I think they're probably pretty appreciable, you know, approachable for kids.
The Mario games, I mean, other than maybe Mario 64, the 2D Mario games I would play as a kid, I always found bastard hard. I could never get anywhere with the 2D
originals. I did love them,
though. I
played them loads.
I think I played them loads, but I don't think I ever got past the third level on any of them.
I think of kids being sort of like limitlessly good at video games. Like, if you give them something that's just challenging, they'll just figure out a way to be amazing at it. My friend Andy, His kid Elliot is, I think, the youngest person ever to reach hell in Spelunky and complete it that way.
Oh, wow.
And he, like, I think probably one of the fastest as well. He just, you know, started from scratch and just decided this was his goal and just kept playing until he was that good. And he was certainly way faster than me.
Kids in their fucking plastic brains. Fuck off. Get out of my anal games.
But then now that you mentioned finding games hard as a kid, I remember I also found games bastard hard. I didn't complete a damn thing. Some adventure games possibly whilst looking at a walkthrough, but everything else it was just, well, there's no way to complete this.
I only ever completed games when I was a kid.
definitely had more time then. If it was possible to complete it, I would do it. But
there was more time and less choice. I think that's the difference. Like, you had a game. That was the game that you had. That's the game you're going to play. And if you weren't good at it, then that was going to be a fucking rubbish 6 months.
See, we would go to the Glasgow bars and buy pirated games. Pound for the first disc, 50 pence for every disc thereafter. So we had a fair selection of Amiga 500 games. And I only realized, though, when I went back, would have been 4 or 5 years ago now, I pirated them again and played them on an emulator. Oh dear.
Millard.
I played them again and I would, you know, play these games that I'd played for, well, in my head, dozens, probably hundreds of hours. And I would reach the fourth level and go, I have no memories of this. I've never seen this level before in my life. And it was just all that time I would just replay, like Lotus 3, which was a racing game I really enjoyed. Could never get past like the third stage. I would always run out of time and die and, you know, back to the start again. But didn't bother me. I still played the game loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads.
I definitely have much lower tolerance for that stuff now. Like, if something's challenging, I just give up. Yeah. Broadly.
Yes, in life as well as games.
Yeah, it's fine, personally. Just in general.
And that's all the questions that we have time for this week.
Very well. You can send us more questions at questions@creightandcrowbar.com. You can tweet at us at creightandcrowbar. You can post them on our forum, creightandcrowbar.com/forum. You can also back us on Patreon. We are at patreon.com/CreightonCrowbar. The Crate and Crowbar name is going to come up a lot in our handles and names for these things. It's more or less that on every single service. YouTube.com/CreightonCrowbar. And we have a Discord chat room, which the URL for which is not as easily recitable, but we put it in every show notes and it's on the side panel of our homepage. And you can follow us on Twitter individually. I am at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
I'm at Mosh Davis, that's DAVIES.
And I am at Gonas, GONNAS.
That was a strange one.
Do some talking, Tom. Do some talking.
Talking, Tom. Talking, Tom. Talking, Tom.
Talking, Tom. Talking, Tom. Talking, Tom.
It's a lovely tune.